Right, with me now is Barney Revel. So, Barney, could you tell us what it is that you did in this series?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm one of the producer directors of the Life on Our Planet series loop, as we always seem to shorten it down to just for ease, but does confuse people when we talk about loop and they give you that quizzical look. But yeah, so I did two of the episodes, Ep 4, which is essentially the age of reptiles, and then Ep 5, which takes us into the dinosaur era.
So you got all potentially the most popular ones.
There was definitely an element of, yeah, I'm going to have those two because they sound like cool shows to make and people are going to love them. So there was, yeah, 100% I was attracted to that idea.
Right. So your first episode, episode 4, the one that we're talking about today, it starts with a lot of scenes that look like very hot and inhospitable environments where we got Lystrosaurus. Where did you have to go to film those?
Yeah, so we wanted environments that could look utterly otherworldly and also somewhere that could be evocative of what it might have been like post-Permian extinction. So essentially dead, barren, inhospitable, dry. You know, you've got Pangaea pulling together, so you're beginning to get the kind of extreme heats. And so we looked around and we looked at various deserts and came up with the Atacama Desert in Chile. So the beauty of this for us is that it was twofold, is that we could, there was a sequence I wanted to shoot there as well. So the salt flat lizards, the natural history sequence that follows Lystrosaurus, we shot there in the Atacama Desert. And it was just a really lovely behavior that reflected how adaptable, but also kind of perfectly designed, if you like, reptiles were for hot, dry, arid environments, you know, something that could distinguish them from the amphibians that came before. And also allowed them in this crazy new world that they'd all found themselves in to actually make a success of it. And then next to that, you know, logistically not too far away, you've got the crazy scenery of the Atacama Desert. I mean, there are some stuff there that is just sort of beyond belief. And you kind of look at some of our shots, or certainly I do, and I think, God, was that VFX? Did we CG that? And it's like, no, literally the only thing in that scene that is created, sort of man-made, if you like, is a tiny little Lystrosaurus in a vast, just surreal environment. So it was a, it was an awesome place to go. And then little Easter eggs on the side for those that know and love those things. It was very much in the kind of Tatooine Jawas stalking C-3PO in that kind of crazy little. Yeah, good. And then we also knew when we were shooting it that the Mandalorian was shooting some backplates out there. So even though the Mandalorian wasn't out, we were kind of like, ooh, that would be cool if they use some of that sort of similar looking places. And obviously we couldn't sort of base anything on that, but it was just nice to see. It's what I've tried to do, is just throw in little tiny references if we can to other stuff, because we all know and love that. And it just makes it even cooler when you've not only got a great story, a great creature doing some cool stuff from the prehistoric past, but you're also like, oh, it's got that sort of just little hints of things that I know and love from popular culture.
Oh wow, this episode is going pretty well. The nerdery that is going to be in this episode.
I try to please the nerds out there.
Cuz honestly, when I saw that Lystrosaurus in the cave, the first thing that came to my head was Star Wars. And then I also wanted to know exactly where it was, cuz I would like to go and sit in that cave and just be like, this is where the Lystrosaurus was. Yeah, what were the challenges of filming in the Atacama?
So the Atacama, I mean, by its name, it's a desert. It's harsh. So that means serious heat, but also really harsh sunlight. And if you look at most natural history documentary series, whatever, everything's shot in that gorgeous warm glow of the sort of dawn dusk type time. And of course in the Atacama Desert that is brief, and also with all the mountains around it, the sun is it doesn't, it only pops over those mountains when it's already just full on blazing harsh. So we had to kind of lean into that, I suppose, and sort of embrace that. And I suppose in many ways it sort of helps the story. It did need to feel like a harsh environment somewhere that was brutal. The Permian extinction wiped out literally, well, basically all life. I mean, all but a tiny percentage of life on land and in the oceans was destroyed in something so cataclysmic that you can barely comprehend. And so we need an environment that could suggest that, that was of this world today. There's also a massive coal gap, so there's no trees around in that time. Like, vegetation was wiped out, which is obviously part of the cause of the death of so many species. But there needed to be something there that whatever life did survive, because obviously we know life did survive, something that it could cling on to. So little plants or just some sort of hint. And the beauty of desert plants is that they look like that. They are sparse, they are few and far between, but they look kind of weird and bizarre, and they've kind of got strange ways of surviving. Because, of course, we can't have any of the classic angiosperms, and God, Tom always ribs me for this, but there are a couple of tiny angiosperms that creep into, I think it's the Lystrosaurus, or maybe the when we meet the Erythrosuchid. But you'd have to be a botanist to kind of know, or certainly most people wouldn't, because being a desert plant, it just looks strange and otherworldly, and it kind of could pass as something. So it's, yeah, it was a tough place to film, but it was a great place because everywhere you looked, it just looked alien.
Oh, I'm just thinking of I'm bringing the nerd stuff back in, and I can't escape the thought that there'll be the Mandalorian and Lystrosaurus walking through the same valley potentially.
Someone needs to create it.
Yeah. Right. So what I loved most about this episode was my recognition of the attention to detail. So specifically the textures. So the scales felt hard. The dry stuff felt brittle and crispy. The wet stuff was sloppy and smelly. So what did you do to make me notice this, and why?
Well, firstly, I'm glad that you did notice. I think with all of, whenever we set out to make a series like this, you want your creatures, but also your stories, to have a different look and feel and flavor so that it doesn't feel monotone either throughout your series or throughout your episode or even throughout the individual sequence. And so much of the story of this episode is about the changing environment. Like, that drove the evolution that happened on the ground, in the air, in the oceans. Like, the world became a harsh, crisp, brittle, sun-dazzled, you know, desert hot environment where things had to adapt to survive in that, in kind of crazy ways. So we wanted the audience, if possible, to feel that. So that's everything. That's from the way we film it, but also the music, the sound effects, and also, I suppose, in the look and the textures of those creatures that have to survive in them. They have to be embedded in those environments. So equally, we've got the CPE. We've got this epic mega monsoonal period that I love because I'd never heard of it. Who knew that it basically effectively rained for a million odd years and completely transformed the planet? And of course, if you transform the planet, if you take it from, bluntly speaking, obviously there's technicalities on this, but from a desert to a swamp, you're going to change who likes living there. And so these environmental factors were driving evolution. And so for me, it's really important that it feels like that, it looks like that, it sounds like that, and that as an audience, you buy into that, because then you understand. Like, then you understand why reptiles might be quite handy in these kind of environments, or why dinosaurs might appear out of kind of nowhere. So yeah, so I'm glad you noticed. I mean, whether I don't know. Often with these things, you don't want to hit people around the head with it, but you want it to just sort of effuse throughout a sequence so that the general feeling is, and people sort of go there without really knowing why. So it's great that you felt that.
Okay, so you had your plan for what this episode should be about and the narrative. Did you build the story around that, or do you work with what you're provided by the camera person at the end? So do you say, like, go out and get me all of this crispy, dry footage? Or at the end, do you create this crispy, dry narrative based on the footage that you've got?
I think we definitely head out with the intention of these things. Like, you know that these deserty environments were driving evolution, and therefore you want that to come across in what you film and all aspects of it. So it was I worked really closely with Jamie McPherson, who is the director of photography on this series. And so he actually shot a lot of the sequences in this show, both natural history and VFX. So we sat in super salty water in the Atacama Desert, basically filled with, I think it was flamingo poo, and it's basically saltier than the Dead Sea. And we were sitting there up to our waists in it, trying not to move in the hottest part of day, waiting for these salt flat lizards to basically encounter each other and have little fights. Because the only time they really got active was in the middle of the day. So it was one of those things where you sort of looked at each other and we're like, what are we doing sitting in flamingo poo in like uber saltiness, trying to film a little lizard in like baking heat? But sorry, off on a random tangent. But it was very much with that intention from the top. And then inevitably, when you come to the edit, you try and pick those shots that reflect that, where you can see the heat haze, where you can see the light. And then we then talk to ILM and we want them to build that into the kind of the gnarly scales on, say, the Erythra Suchid, and equally into the wetness of, you know, just that epic rain to make it feel truly biblical. You want that to feel all pervading. So it's not just like, oh, it rained the other day. Yeah, it was pretty heavy. It's like, no, this needs to feel like the biggest rainstorm that anyone had ever seen ever in the world that's ever been. And so that's hard to kind of do, because you're like, okay, well, what are we going to do for that? So we randomly went to a quarry just outside Bristol, and we took a couple of fire trucks that had, I think it was like, how many thousand liters of essentially rainwater runoff, got these epic amounts of lights, and basically just drenched the quarry walls and shot it at high speed. And it was awesome. It was great fun. But it was like, it's the kind of thing that you don't naturally see in the natural world. And I think I thought it'd be really easy to find really loads of rain and heavy storm stuff. So I was like, oh, that'd be some great archival. We can shoot it. The trouble is, if you think about it, every time you see rain that looks truly epic, it's generally because there's like a torch or a car headlamp, a Jeep, usually if it's some kind of like horror movie. And there was also hard straight lines that the rain then is sort of up against, and they're usually kind of lit, that makes it really feel heavy and biblical.
Mm.
In the natural world, plants sort of waft and move, everything's slightly muted. And of course, when it rains that heavily, it's essentially dark. So if you try and film that for real, it's really tough, and you've got to be super lucky. So we were like, well, let's just create our own mega monsoon.
Yeah, I did wonder where on earth did you film that? Like, I couldn't believe, like, whoa, that this exists somewhere in the world. And I was like, is it a waterfall? No, is it I couldn't figure it out. Is it a river that's burst its back? And it's you in a quarry.
So it's a real mix of stuff in that sequence. There's shots in a quarry where we literally hosed down sort of rock faces. There's macro stuff of like water droplets done in a studio. There's stuff from Iceland, which is a lot, it's the big, that uber waterfall, which, God, what's the film that was shot there, the opening sequence of, I can't remember, another random Easter egg for you.
Prometheus?
Exactly, thank you. So it's that waterfall. Just throwing these things in there just to get the geeks excited.
Yeah, that's me.
And then we took some storm chaser footage from the US, basically some of those crazy time lapses of clouds, and then bespoke shot some mountain ridges that were at the same angle and the right height, and composited them together to get some of those time lapses in amongst that kind of rocky, mountainous environment. So it was a lot of, I loved that sequence because it was a real creative endeavor to create something that felt like it was beyond what you might see on our planet today. And I love it. I think it's great. I think Lorne did a fantastic job with the music, sort of really building up into some epic crescendo. And you get a sense that the world transformed. And then out of that came the dinosaurs.
Oh, wow. This is exactly what I was after for this kind of podcast series, you know, just like digging into these kinds of details. Do you get the opportunity to talk about this kind of stuff a lot?
Not that much. I love talking about it. It's great actually to be able to. We've been under such strict NDAs for what feels like an entire lifetime. So to be able to talk about it and also have people that are interested, but I find it fascinating. It's what keeps it alive for me. It's the challenge. It's the thrill of it all is going, you know, someone goes, right, I need a biblical rainstorm like never seen before. It rained for over a million years. And you're like, okay, right, how am I going to do that? You know, like, what does that look like? How do you even begin to put that together? And working with team and the people around and getting, you know, you slowly come together and devise ways. And then one of the best feelings is when you're in the final mix. So the final mix is when we essentially, the very end of the process, you mix together what the composers, the music's done, the voiceover, all the sound effects and atmospheres that are sort of laid down to help create an actual environment. And you put them all together in a big mixing studio with the final pictures on a big screen. And it's the most joyous experience because you get to see it all, like, essentially you see it like you'll probably never see it again because unfortunately it's probably on your laptop or your telly watching Netflix. So it's not quite the same experience. But yeah, that's great when you actually have that final moment and it all comes together.
Oh, I bet. Right. So in this episode, Erythrosuchus and Plateosaurus, potato, potato. They're amongst my favorite models in the series. Yes. And they feel very detailed, textured. So how much detail and attention to detail goes into convincing us of the physicality of that CGI model, as opposed to, you know, like just getting, you know, like the size and proportion and behavior and movement correct?
Well, firstly, I'm glad you like those two models. They're some of my favorites too, absolutely. They were certainly, the Erythrosuchid was one of the earliest ones. And also, I should say, just to be pedantic, we do call it an Erythrosuchid, as in the larger group, just because I think, and you'll double check with either your literature or with Tom's, that I think we couldn't call it an Erythrosuchus because the Erythrosuchus species doesn't directly overlap with the Lystrosaurus species that we were depicting.
Right.
I think we had to go with an Erythrosuchid. Anyway, too much detail for most, but maybe not for your audiences.
Not for our audience. They'll be all over that.
But you should definitely clarify that with Tom, just in case I'm getting it wrong, because I do have a hand of doing that. But for sure, Eric is what we call the Erythrosuchid. So Eric is awesome. Like the texture and the detail, like you say, that shot where the foot walks and you see its skin or you're looking at the eye. I mean, there's some attention to detail there that ILM put in with some of the, I don't know, the dirt between the scales and stuff. Mm. Just remarkable what they did. And I love it. I mean, it's beautiful. And similarly, the Plateosaurus, I mean, that was a tough ask. We needed something that could be small, cute, endearing, but also it had to walk that line and tell the story of, like, it's kind of like a reptile. So it's got these things that look like reptiles. We kind of reckon, you know, it's out of an egg. It's kind of got the skin. It's got all these things, but it's a bit different. And there's something that differentiates, you know, that is their own little kind of subset of reptiles. And, like, how do you show that? How do you make that happen without it being a dry sort of technical sequence? And so we had this magical little glade in the woods where it's all sort of sparkly, and out of the moss come these little cute little creatures that, of course, grow into giants. And that was very much an intentional trying, you know, Easter egg for those that love your Jurassics. Essentially, the first time, other than say Ep 1, that you see a dinosaur in our series is that moment when the Plateosaurus baby meets Plateosaurus adult. Camera lifts up, it lifts up and eat. And it's we're trying in that ludicrous way that we do these little things, but we're trying to sort of get you to remember the very first time you probably saw a dinosaur, which was Jurassic Park, and that, what is it, Brachiosaurus reaching out to eat the leaves while they sit in the Jeep with their glasses falling off their eyes and being slightly starstruck. And so those, they're little moments, but I love that. That kind of stuff. And going back to your question, there's no point having the perfect model if it doesn't move right, if it doesn't behave correctly, if it doesn't sit within the environment. And it's so many of those things need to come together to make it believable and convincing. And there is so much work that goes into that. And you want it to work on so many levels. And so we gave so much information to ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, video references, like other kind of, descriptions. We would then, they would send us models. We'd annotate them with like, oh, it needs to be like legs a little more splayed, or like the forehead's a bit too big, the eyes are too bulbous, or whatever it might have been, just trying to refine it and refine it. But it's hard. And there's only so far you can go. You know, you want it to be perfect, but ultimately there's no point having a 100% perfect model if you spent all your resources and it can't actually move correctly. Mm. So at some point you do have to move on and make tiny compromises. And I suppose what we tried to do wherever possible was to make those compromises as small as possible. And also what I realized is, because we storyboarded every sequence, I was like, well, actually, why are we sweating, say, the claws on their feet when you never see them? Because they're all, you know, every shot that we have storyboarded, the feet are either hidden behind vegetation or they're out of shot. So actually we can not worry about that, but we do have a big close-up of their face where you can see where their ear is, or what their eyelids are like, or the lack of. Or so it was always a kind of a balancing act, because we got a great budget for this series, no denying that, but it's not limitless and it's not as big as some others out there, and you do have to make those choices, and you want it to be as good as possible, and you want it to be as believable as possible. And we were super concerned about making sure that the paleo community loved our creatures. And that's, as I'm sure you know, is tough. Like, it's a hard audience out there. And also it's not one that necessarily agrees even amongst themselves.
Mm.
So walking that line of what's acceptable, what's not, what's pushing the boat out. It's not an easy process, but it's a fun process and it was great to do. And God, you know, I hope people like it as much as we do.
Yeah. I spoke to Ida earlier about, you know, having to come down one side of the fence or other when you're making a physical representation of something. There's no hedging your bets. You are all in on one possible interpretation, and whatever you do, you're going to get criticism from the opposite viewpoint.
Exactly. So, yeah. I think we took that on board early on, that we would never be able to please everybody, because if we were, then that's not a real, you know, that's not possible. And it was also trying to make sure that fundamentally the stories worked, that the the general emotion and the drive to watch these episodes and the knowledge you're learning was entertaining, enlightening, and great fun. And that's the fundamental drive. We are, I'm afraid, making it for Netflix and the biggest audience possible. But at the same time, there's no reason not to try and make it as accurately as possible and to get people like yourself and all these various professors to kind of help us and advise us so that we can do as good a job as we possibly can to make it correct. But inevitably, there are limitations and there are disagreements. And we have to decide at some point, okay, how big is this? I don't know, are there lips or like how much fur do they have? Do they have hair, feathers, you know, what color? We have to make a choice and that will upset somebody somewhere. But, you know, I like where we ended up, which is good.
Yeah. So how many iterations of each model would you have to have gone through with Industrial Light and Magic?
It depended. I mean, lots is the short answer. Sometimes they really got it like quick. Like we put together these, these huge fact files that gave every tiny bit of detail that we could possibly think of about everything, skeleton, body mass, through to nails, eyes, skin, wherever possible, and there was factual information from the paleo community, we try to include it. We put references from your, whatever it is, phylogenetic bracketing of other things that could inform how they might move, how they might look. You know, when it's getting more speculative, you're kind of trying to bracket it into things that are believable and that make sense for the animal and the lineage that it comes from. So we would put a huge amount of info into it. And sometimes, if I'm honest, it was maybe too much info and it was maybe too confusing. And so ILM would kind of go with something that we were like, oh, wow, I didn't realize you were going to go with that image as your main reference. I'd only put that in there as a reference for its, I don't know, toenails. And actually, maybe you're looking at it as a reference for its skin kind of texture. And so we refined our system and got more specific about what we were trying to get them to learn from everything that we put together. But they were brilliant. You know, they would take what we put together and just come back with some of the most remarkable creatures. And we're always happy to adapt them and change them. And what I loved about it is that so many of the artists from ILM were complete dino geeks as well. Like some of them knew, like, as much, I don't know, certainly in conversation, were at your level of like knowledge and understanding. Like they were passionate and that was brilliant. They weren't just doing this job, just like cashing the check and like, yeah, I'm out at 5 p.m. They wanted to get it as right as possible and they loved the whole genre. And often had done the big superhero kind of comic book stuff as well as maybe the Jurassic, where they weren't able to be as accurate as they would have liked. And so the opportunity to really get it accurate, to use actual animals from today's planet that could reference and inform, was a big thing for them. And a challenge for them, because it's easy if you're in a Jurassic world and you've got someone screaming and the camera whips around, you see a dino and it roars and then you whip away and it piles through the undergrowth. That's sort of like, that's the world it's in and it can kind of be what it wants. And the glimpse you see of that animal is essentially pretty brief. In our world, it's like, okay, we're going to track along this animal. We're going to look at it. Right, now we're going to push in really tight and have a look at its like face as he's walking. And he's going to stop. And so we're going to actually like go even tighter on his like elbow or I don't know. And like, so there's nowhere to hide when you're creating an animal like that. Like there's no sort of trickery or camera angles or whipping around or panic or chaos that you usually have when there's some kind of prehistoric monster in these movies. We're like staring at them for like seconds, even minutes at a time, like we do the natural world when we film it. And so that was scary for them. I remember having a chat with Jonathan JP, our ILM supervisor, and he was like, not only are you going to get better VFX than are in a lot of the big blockbusters, we kind of have to, because we're so exposed in this series. Like, you are staring at these creatures and it just, like, there's nowhere to hide for them. So it was great. Scary, but great.
Yeah, that, what I loved about Eric, was it the Erythrosid kid, was just that. When we are introduced to Eric, Eric is just sat there and is just facing the camera, and it's just us and him, and we're looking at those details. We're looking at the muck and the old scales stuck in between the new scales and stuff. We're looking at the eyes, we're looking at the teeth, the face. We are just there staring eye to eye with it. And I just love that, you know, it wasn't like that Jurassic World kind of run through and just do the action scene that it needed to do. It was just that organism in front of us. And I loved it.
Great. Good. Oh, well, that was 100% our intention with these things. It's, you want to be as fascinated, as bewitched by these animals as you are in the natural world. Like, when we make series like Our Planet, it relies on the fact that people just are mesmerized by creatures that live in the natural world and the detail of what their skin is like and just the beauty of it. And that is sort of a fundamental, because these creatures didn't live on another planet. They weren't on some, they're not just make believe or made up. The very basis of this series is to remind you that this happened right here just a few years back. I mean, okay, maybe millions of years back, but it was on our planet. It was on the ground beneath our feet today. These creatures lived, walked, breathed, and did whatever they did. And it's that kind of sense that drove a lot of our decision-making. You know, the idea that we wanted to shoot all the backplates for real, because you can CG things. If you look at The Lion King and stuff like that, they went for full CG environments. And they're kind of beautiful in that sort of Avatar way, but they're a sort of a make-believe world that you buy into. And as an audience, after, say, 5-10 minutes, you kind of get swept away in the story and you're there. Whereas we knew we were going to be cutting back and forth from real animals, Komodo dragons in the jungles. It was, so they'd be directly compared between the two. And we didn't want it to feel like, oh, here's some make-believe crazy planet somewhere in some just a total made-up world, and then it's back to reality. We wanted those animals to feel like they did live and breathe and walk on this planet, but just a few years back.
So given the fact that, you know, you can't, like, put a bottomless pit of money into the CGI, there's no limit to how much you could potentially generate in that, but you're constrained by time, you're constrained by budget, you're constrained by the stories that you're telling and what you need to show. Is there anything that you felt that you weren't able to show that you wanted in your episodes but couldn't get in?
There's always more you want. Always. But you're right. There's a limit. We're trying to tell a singular narrative of the story of life. And so you need people to be going on that journey and remembering what that story is. And so you need those sequences to be relevant to that story. Like, we worked really hard to make sure that both our natural history sequences and our VFX sequences helped tell that narrative. I really didn't want in my episode to feel like they were just, oh, that's cool and that's kind of crazy behavior, but, like, anyway, back to the narrative on the sort of the bits between the sequences. I wanted that sequence to reflect the bigger story. You know, like the Komodo dragons, it's basically helping us realize what a world may have been like when it was ruled by reptiles. It's somewhere that still to this day on our planet, the top predator is a big reptile. And the mammals are kind of, you know, these buffalo are kind of introduced and pretty rubbish at what they do. And And but not only the top predator, kind of all levels of the ecosystem are kind of reptile dominated in that place. There's lizards of all sizes, whether it's, you know, small Komodos or big ones or other species. And so it was a great sequence that allowed us to get a sense of what that could have been like, because it's really hard when you think there's no mammals, like what a whole world, or, you know, very little mammals. That's like, that's difficult to comprehend. But I hope that kind of sequence, as well as being beautiful and natural history and gorgeous behavior, help people in that understanding of this prehistoric world and what it was like. So yeah, so back to your point, I mean, of course there were things I would have loved to have done more. I would have loved to have spent more time getting some of the models even better, some of the movements, some of the embeddedness into the environments even better. But you do reach a point where you're like, you have to stop, because otherwise you've got no money left to spend on your other sequences. So it's hard, because you want it to be as good as possible, but you do have to reach a moment at some point. JP was very useful, JP our VFX super, at helping us structure our sequences, in the sense that he would tell us, look, there's some things in the even if you've got unlimited money, like blockbuster style, hundreds of millions, watch them and then think, that doesn't look that great, does it? And he said, that's because VFX is only so far. There are some things they struggle with, like big mega, I don't know, floods and, you know, that sort of interaction of water with destroying things. Like, it's better to be done in real world. Like, you can try and do that kind of chaos in VFX, but it always looks a bit lame. And so he was like, if you create your stories in a way that sort of avoids those things that were never, even with all the money in the world, going to make look that good, but lean into the things that we can do well and that we can really nail, your sequences will look better or as good as any blockbuster out there for a fraction of the price. But yeah, if you try and do things that are impossible, or like that, you know, it's no matter what we do, it's always going to look a bit pants. As far as actual species or creatures, I always really wanted to do some of the crazy croc relatives in the late Triassic.
Yes.
Your bipedal, vegetarian, I don't know, tree dwelling, were they? I mean, like, there's some, like, that whole world is like, what? Someone needs to make a whole show about just that time, because, oh my word, there's some weird ass stuff going on. And that would have been cool. But it was kind of an evolutionary dead end. It didn't help our narrative as far as what was going on, because, yes, some crocs came through, but they sort of looked like the crocs today. And it would have been hard to fit into the story, and I would have had to spend a lot of money building those assets, which is a lot of money. And just, it didn't feel like in the whole body of the show that it was an avenue that I could explore, much as I would have loved to.
All right. Well, you got a second episode to talk to us about as well. So you did get more story in the Mesozoic. So would you be happy to come on and talk us through that one as well?
100%. Love to. No. Age of the Dinosaurs. Bring it.